I want to approach the question of impeachment by way of Easter and Passover. A strange approach, perhaps, but one suggested by the day and one which I hope you will find suggestive. Today, the churches are decked in white, full of lilies. People are joyously decked out in sartorial splendor. And the halls reverberate with grand hymns, Hosanna, Hallelujah, glorifying and magnifying the faith in the risen Christ. Easter is a great holy day of deliverance and redemption, in which man is, in a sense, resurrected from the humdrum and the mundane and the all that is inadequate, transformed into a holy being, given possibility, provided with hope. Now, the word Easter is not the original label of the holiday. Oster was the Teutonic goddess of the dawn, of the spring. When missionaries brought from the Mediterranean lands the faith in the Christ, the dawn of a new age through the death of the Son of God, a great holiday celebrating this dawn, this new hope in the springtime of the year. It was quite natural for the rather primitive Germanic peoples to amalgamate Oster and the Christian God, to create out of the spring holiday which was familiar to them, Easter. In the Romance languages, in the languages of those countries which border the Mediterranean, the original label of Easter is preserved. The French, of course, call Easter Pâques. Pâques is derived from Pascha, an old Greek term, which itself is simply a transliteration of Pesach, the Passover. The times of the early Christians, Passover was the great pilgrimage festival in which Jews came from all over Judea and the Galilee to Jerusalem to celebrate redemption and deliverance from bondage in Egypt, to speak of the possibility of deliverance and redemption in their own day, and to participate in the Paschal sacrifice. In that world, Pesach was essentially a generic term for a festival of deliverance, a feast of redemption. And it was in that sense that it was taken over as Pascha by the early Christians. It became the term, the label of the Easter holiday. Now, I suppose that Passover and Easter, coming as they do, coinciding as they do in the springtime of the year, is a time in which Christians are most conscious of their Jewish origins. And Jews are most self-conscious about what Rotarians in both communities tend to call the Judeo-Christian tradition. There seem to be so many similarities. Pascha, Pesach, the very name. The coincidence of the timing of these holidays, the springtime of the year. Actually, the Easter used to be celebrated on the same day as Passover. The legendary association of the Last Supper with the Seder. And finally, the underlying concept of redemption, of deliverance. All these suggest the commonality of these true religious traditions. I sometimes think that there are more Siddurim, more Seders observed in the churches of Cleveland than in the Jewish homes of Cleveland. And there are some Jews for whom the observance of Seder in a Christian church is somehow an act of greater devotion than celebrating the Seder in a Jewish home. But be that as it may, despite the suggestion of commonality, Easter is somehow also the time of the year in which we as Jews understand, perhaps more clearly than at any other time, the essential difference, the many differences, which exist between these two Western religious traditions. For Easter draws into itself all the basic themes of Christology, all the basic elements of the Christ myth, all that essentially separates Christianity from the biblical tradition. But we must deal, when we deal with Easter, with the possibility of the death of a God, an inconceivable possibility among Jews. We must deal with the concept of a God who can have a son, of a human being who can also be a God, of a God who somehow takes upon himself the suffering of mankind and who suffers, and through that vicarious suffering delivers mankind from pain and anguish and incapacity. We must deal with the empty tomb, and this whole basis of a miracle of resurrection. And all these elements that seem strange to us, foreign from our particular tradition, and when we add to those the shadowy historic vibrations which come to us from our past, when this weekend between Good Friday and Easter Sunday was a time in which the Jews were prohibited from leaving the ghettos and the al-yamans, the Jewries of Europe, lest their presence among the streets be an affront to the believing Christians. After all, we were the deicides, the Christ killers. When you add history to Christology, Jews begin to understand that there is a gap, a chasm, a difference between the two faiths. Passover celebrates the great historic public deliverance of a people. It's Zaman Chirutenu, the time of our deliverance. We were slaves, and then, miraculously, through God's agency, we were freed. And the existential meaning of Passover is that there must be an end to tyranny everywhere. There must be an end to all oppression. Man must be free and secure and independent within his communities. On the other hand, Easter celebrates the private faith in an individual resurrection. There is little about Easter which deals with community, with a people. It doesn't deal with political facts. It deals with faith. The faith in a God who died for man's sin and who has risen and who will come again. The faith in a God who promises salvation and redemption and resurrection to those who believe in him. The emphasis of Passover is communal. The emphasis of Easter is private. The emphasis of Passover is public, communal, historic. The emphasis of Easter is private, salvationistic, redemptive, resurrectionist. Now, what has all of this to do with impeachment? Simply this. In the early history of this country, the founders went back to the biblical tradition. And they established freedom on the basis of the Exodus and on the basis of law of Sinai, a constitution. The constitution is the Torah. And there was to be a community and a judicial system, the Beit Din, the Kehillah. There was to be due process in the ballot. The emphasis was on the natural rights and responsibilities of men within a social context. King George was Pharaoh. The revolutionaries were the armies of the Jews, the children of Israel leaving Egypt. The constitution was Sinai. And the hope was that men and women would create here in this new land a social order, a political order in which there would be true justice and therefore true freedom. The emphasis was on community. And what I'd like to suggest this morning, as we look not only to the issue to impeach or not to impeach, but we look behind the issue to how we got into this mess in the first place. I'd like to suggest in the last few decades, Americans have tended to move in their thinking from Passover to Easter, from community to the primacy of their religious faith, to the primacy of some cause, of some crusade, and that they have been willing to set this concern with a kingdom which is not of this world, with their own purity of actions, with their own commitments to some pure vision of the truth, above constitution, above due process, above the social order. That paradoxically, Mr. Nixon and his problems and much else in the American society represents a renaissance of primitive Christian messianism, millenarianism, and faith. And that we must understand this Christian tradition and what it means, Easter, if we want to understand many of the problems and many of the attitudes which surge within our nation today. And further, I would suggest to you that there is a basic tug of war going on in our nation between Passover and Easter, between community and the individual, between a commitment to the social order and a commitment to individual salvation. And that in the resolution of that commitment, I believe lies much of the fate of this country. But before I try to draw out this thesis, let me briefly tell you where I stand on the issue of impeachment so you know the perspective and the bias from which I speak. As you know, because I've said it publicly from this pulpit, I believe and have long believed that President Nixon ought to resign. And I believe this for very practical and pragmatic reasons. I believe that he has lost that one essential factor which any leader of a free society must have in order to be able to lead effectively. And that is the consent, the willing consent of the governed. It seems to me eminently clear that from the polls and from what I hear, that the vast majority of the American people no longer find the president to be creditable. And I do not believe that this fall in the public attitude, so precipitous, is reversible. I believe that he has lost all ability to resurrect himself in the public mind. And as proof, I would offer to you the various operations, candor, which he has attempted, all of which have fizzled and failed. Now, the reasons that people have turned away from this president whom they voted in hardly 2 years ago by the greatest plurality ever are many, and they're varied. Some believe Mr. Nixon to have been intimately involved, implicitly or explicitly, in the Watergate cover-up. Certainly, he participated in meetings with campaign contributors, big corporations, the milk industry, the AT&T, who wanted special favors, tariffs, foreign activities in Chile and elsewhere, subsidies from the government. They feel that Mr. Nixon has violated, by his actions, his oath of office. And there are others who find simply the president guilty of cupidity, venality, simple, ordinary greed, who cannot imagine a president who pays less in income tax than a secretary in his office, who can't imagine a president building his winter palace and his summer palace at the expense of the taxpayer, who cannot imagine a president allowing his daughter to receive a trust fund from a man who just happens to be the president of a large drug company at the moment seeking redress from congressional investigation. And there are some who cannot forgive the president for exposing the hopes that they invested in him. They voted for honor, honesty in government. They voted for fiscal responsibility. They voted for quiet streets. And instead of honor, they got a White House filled with at least 12 men who have now been indicted for perjury. Instead of fiscal responsibility, they got a man who obviously has been busy feathering his own nest. Instead of quiet streets, they got a White House prepared to deal, at the very least, in extra legal means to deal with its enemies, those who were out of favor. And there are, of course, many who have simply been beaten down by the staccato of charges and evidence which show that the Watergate was an isolated event in a seeping morass of political manipulation, which had many purposes, advantage of a man, of a party, of a president, furtherance of ideological causes, fiscal advantage. Watergate, the plumbers, the dirty tricks, the erased tapes, the missing letters, the missing tapes, the suborning of a federal judge, the matters of the income tax, the matters of several estates, the matters of the trust fund, the unwillingness to cooperate with the special prosecutor and the firing of the special prosecutor, the unwillingness to cooperate with Congress and delay in submitting to Congress materials needed for its investigation, the meeting with various lobbyists, leaders of special interest, the campaign to shake down the giant corporations in the United States for private administrative advantage in the elections, the attack on the integrity of the press, the attack on the integrity of the judiciary, and on, on, and on, and on. Now, if my reasons for believing that the president ought to resign are practical and pragmatic, the reasons that I believe that he ought to be impeached and tried, and I do believe that, are legal. They are simply this, that I believe that there's enough evidence now for the Congress to bring charges of high crimes and misdemeanors against this president. I think it's clear that he has been guilty of violations of his oath of office, malfeasance, misfeasance, in the matter of preferential treatment of corporations and campaign contributors. There's the crime that's implicit in those tens of thousands of dollars lying around unaccounted for in various so-called safe deposit boxes, apparently being used hither and yon for one purpose or another. There's a very serious charge of having suborned a federal judge sitting in a case central to the whole Watergate, the Ellsberg case, for the promise or the offer of high office. There's the question of overt, if not covert, involvement in the cover-up itself. There's a question of the president's malfeasance or misfeasance in trying to bring together in the White House a special investigative unit not authorized by the Congress, and to bring to this unit or to the White House information on his infamous enemies list and others, which was privileged in the Internal Revenue Service or elsewhere. There has been the question of civil fraud raised about his income tax. And there is certainly evidence that he unleashed the lobbyists of the White House a few years ago on Congress in order to delay or to prevent the passage of legislation which would have explicitly prohibited the donations of papers which belong in the first instance to the American people, to the American government, and the taking of a large tax write-off from them. I don't know all the charges which can be or will be cited, but I would suggest to you that the constitutional terms for indictment, high crimes and misdemeanors, can be met, and that this president should be tried under them. But having said that, I think that there is more advantage for us try and understand how we got here, how he got here, why we find ourselves at this moment in time embarrassed by an administration which has convicted itself in the minds of a majority, certainly, of the American people of high crimes and misdemeanors, so many of whose members are now under indictment or are in prison, or will be indicted soon. And I would suggest to you, as I have already, that the framework for understanding, I believe, begins in this tension, which is at the root of any social order, between the community and commitment, between faith and the compromises and adjustments needed to maintain a legal social order. You recall that when the president refused to obey Judge Sirica's ruling that he must turn over the 8 original tapes to the special prosecutor's office, the case was referred to the Circuit Court of Appeals, and in answering, in ruling, the majority of the judges said, the president does not embody the national sovereignty. He is not above the law's command. And I suspect that there are many who believe that the issue lies essentially here. The imperial presidency, King Nixon, the summer palaces and the winter palaces, the dressing up of a royal bodyguard, the walling of oneself in from the common herd, the unapproachability. And there have been, as you know, learned books written on this general theme of the growth of the imperial presidency in these United States. Certainly power corrupts. The kind of power that a president of the United States enjoys must inevitably corrupt the man to a certain degree who is charged with that office. But I'm trying to suggest that what we have here is not simply the corruption of a man, nor even, I would suggest, the transformation of an office to which we've allowed greater and greater powers to run, to accrue over the last years. But we're seeing here the cost of an attitude towards the truth, towards self, towards community, towards cause, which has been growing and growing in America over the last many decades, certainly very strongly since the end of the Second World War. We have been suffering, I would submit, from the stench of holiness. We've been suffering from commitment. We've been suffering from the passion of the early Christian who was challenged by Jesus that his kingdom was not of this world, who was told not to be a good citizen, but to be a fool for God, to turn away from family, to turn away from responsibility in the community, to go out into the wilderness to pray, to fast, to prepare himself for the coming of the kingdom. It was the emphasis on the truth of the new vision which allowed so many of these early Christians to become what the Romans called undesirable citizens. They could not be trusted. They would not assume office because somehow being in office inevitably corrupted them, forced them to deal with the uncertainties, the lack of clarity of the problems of every day. Paradoxically, I would submit, and I'm afraid that many of my good Christian ministerial friends would not like these terms, I would submit that over the last 30 years, even as America has become less churchy, the American spirit has become more Christian in this classic sense. We saw it first during the McCarthy era, when the good senator and his bully boys set out to purge America of the taint of all that was red and all that was picked, and they didn't care the least about the means that they chose to do it. Vilification, charge without the ability of, without witnesses testifying in open court, without the ability of those charged to speak up in their own behalf. There was a cause. There was a holy crusade. This crusade was taken up by the white citizens' councils and by the Birchers, by the Minutemen, by all kinds of people on the right, and how we damned it and how we condemned it and how self-righteous we felt. But in the 50s, and more especially in the 60s, that same stench of holiness, that same sense of the crusade began to appear more and more on the left, and to be associated more and more with advocates of causes to which we felt some basic sympathy. Racism, civil rights, social justice, the war on poverty. Men began to feel the need to speak of an immediate overturning of the American social order so that the underprivileged would have what they needed now, not 10 years from now, but now. Marches were ordered on Washington in order to bring the American government to a stop. And our courts were turned into propaganda machines where those who were charged with disturbing the peace, call it what you will, did not simply stand up and honorably speak out what was on their minds, but vilified the judge and the system and the court and due process and all that it stood for. And there were among the theologians of the left, men like Herbert Marcuse and others, who argued that we must end the free press because falsity, that which is not true, has really no right to be heard. Left and right, there's been a growing crescendo of opinion, a growing attitude in America, which is willing to set the individual above the community, in which the individual finds it imperative for him to be pure, committed, rather than to be involved in the weave, the complexities of life in community, in which if the world will not transform itself to do what I want it to do, what I feel it must become now, any means that I choose in order to gain that end are justified by the end. And I would submit to you that Mr. Nixon is but another one of the victims of this new attitude, this new emphasis on morality and on holiness, on the holy crusade in American life. He is the obverse of those who are out in the streets, barricaded in his White House, surrounded by his crew-cut Ehrlichmans and Haldemans. This group of people saw themselves as a band of crusaders who had to, in a brief time, overturn all those who were long-haired and outside and across the fence were trying to achieve in their own way. Each was trying to outdo the other, to overturn the other without concern for the law, without concern for community. Any means in this war of Gog and Magog just was justified by the holy end, which each saw. They saw the vision. They had the truth. And that was enough. I don't think that Mr. Nixon would like himself to be bracketed with the long-haired. And I'm sure the long-haired would not like to be bracketed with Mr. Nixon. But I submit to you that these two groups whom I have symbolized are similar in their attitudes. They are true believers. They are crusaders. They understand Easter. They understand the second coming. There's the vision of the millennium. There was a truth. There was a clean purity. And I must somehow participate in that. You know, when the Jews came out of Egypt, the Bible describes them as an Erev Rav, a motley, a mixed multitude, an asafsuf. And immediately they gained freedom. God and Moses brought them to Mount Sinai, to a law. And it was only when they were committed to the law, to the covenant, to a community, that this motley became a people. And we Jews have spoken always in terms of Am Yisrael, the people of Israel. The kehila, the community. We inevitably, essentially, naturally speak in communal terms. It's a truism among us that Al tifrosh min hatzibur, not to separate yourself from the community. The word nation, the word people, is an anomaly when you put it side by side with Christianity. It is not the Christian nation, it's the mystic body of Christ. And Christianity is not on its way to a promised land, which is a piece of real estate. It's on its way to a promised land, which is paradise, which is heaven. And when Mr. Nixon associates himself with the Christianity of Billy Graham and draws Billy Graham to himself as a symbol of all that he in his heart of hearts is trying to do, he's being very honest. Because this kind of fundamentalist, evangelical, millenarian Christianity is precisely at the basis of all that is going wrong in American life today. And all that Passover stands diametrically opposed to. What I do becomes more important than what the community needs. The goal is my resurrection and not the renewal of justice in the social order. The demands that are made on me are incredibly difficult. I must be a fool for Christ, monastic, celibate, denying myself. rather than somehow managing to cope, to live in the world as it is, the real world. Commitment is one of those hallowed words in American life today. We're committed to everything, passionately, as long as we believe in it. Commitment's a very dangerous word, because commitment implies all degrees of belief, ranging from a judgment to fanaticism. The current secular Christianization of America, reflected to our left and to our right, reflected in the radical chic of the new left, reflected in the White House of Mr. Nixon. This Christianization is corrosive of the social order. The Romans knew it. The Romans in the second century attacked the Christians, not because they were simple people of goodwill and great faith, but because the Christians would not participate in the social order. They would not be shackled to the world as it is. They wanted a world transformed, and the good senators and Caesars of Rome knew no way in which to transform the world. And those who want to transform the world, interestingly, destroy the ability of the world to transform itself. In the fourth century, when Christianity became under Constantine and the Roman emperors the dominant state faith, did not promote the republic that was once Rome, but it promoted Caesaropapism, the Byzantine Empire, an autocratic imperial church state which was as intolerant of human need and human diversity as any empire the world has ever known. I do not believe that Judaism contains all truth, or that Passover represents the entire range of a social and religious philosophy. But I do believe that if democracy or the republic has any chance of surviving, its citizens, we, must somehow recapture the Passover spirit. The humility to recognize that we cannot transform the world tomorrow. The sympathy which makes us recognize that we are part of a social order and must work through it, not to impose upon it our own peculiar view of that in which salvation consists. Because as in Byzantine Rome, as in the White House of Mr. Nixon, as in the authoritarianism of the New Left, the fanatics of change are always tyrants, imposing their will from above. We have to somehow learn again respect for law, the courts, due process, a respect for the Constitution and constitutionality, for that which is legal. It does not mean that we ought to abandon social concern. There is implicit in Judaism the possibility of social reform. In the Talmud itself, you find the phrase, Et la'asot la'dunai heferu togatecha, when it's time to do something for God, overturn the law. But there are two ways of doing it. One is the way of a Dr. Martin Luther King, who sees injustice, who takes his stand deliberately to break the law, and then who proudly and nobly accepts the responsibility under the law for his act, knowing that he will somehow appeal to the conscience of the nation and rouse the nation and its at the ballot box and the schools and the social agencies and elsewhere to begin to change the social order. Mr. Lincoln faced the unfavorable Dred Scott decision. He said this: "We do not propose that when Dred Scott has been decided to be a slave by the court, we as a mob will decide him to be free. But we nevertheless do oppose that decision as a political role which should and shall be reversed." That's one way. That's a way a society must tolerate, must applaud, and must vigorously respond to. But when vast numbers of people in the society, each with his own gospel, are running around to change the social order with demonstrations or sit-downs or placards or bombs, however you will, or with FBI agents and CIA agents and White House agents, however you will, then you have the beginnings of anarchy. You have people who are not willing to let the decision ultimately may be made by the people at the ballot box in their conscience, who are trying to, by strategy, to force people to do what they will. Whenever people list their enemies, beware of them. Beware of them. The left knew its enemies, Mr. Nixon. And Mr. Nixon had his enemies list. And both of these views are paranoid. And paranoid is another way of saying fundamentalist Christian, because they set the view of the soul of the individual above all worldly and earthly consequences. Passover is over and Easter is here. And I presume that from many pulpits in America you will hear words not unlike what I've said today, although obviously not in the frame in which I've said it. For the Christianity of which I speak is not necessarily the Christianity of many of the so-called liberal pulpits, but it's essential Christianity in its classic sense. And many of those who are showing this Christian attitude today are not believers. They're not church people. I speak of an attitude, an approach to life. They are millenarians. They believe in the second coming, that it will be soon.